clothes are consistent, the size, the location.
Police say they found the remains of the missing Kenai family. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Dan Sullivan addresses the legislature for the first time today as a senator.
On some of the most critical issues facing our state and country, the administration of Barack Obama does not have our interests at heart.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Police investigators in Kenai are confident they've found the remains of a family missing since last May. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
A homicide investigation is underway for missing 22-year-old Rebecca Adams, her daughters, 5-year-old Michelle Hundley, and 3-year-old Jerrica, and also Adams' boyfriend, 37-year-old Brandon Jividen. The family left virtually no trace when they were last seen 10 months ago, until this weekend. Here's Kenai Police Lieutenant David Ross.
Saturday evening, about 9:50, the Kenai Police Department received notification from a person traveling in the area that they saw a piece of clothing off the trail. They got out and located what appeared to be human remains.
Ross gave few details on what exactly was found, but did say a handgun was also left at the scene and that the remains matched with what they had been searching for.
The clothes are consistent. The size, the location, I mean, we're very confident it is, but obviously we'll be looking for the medical examiner's confirmation through DNA testing and so forth.
Local police, FBI, and scores of other family members, friends, and neighbors combed the area in North Kenai for months, but it turned up little. The remains were found in an area very near the missing family's apartment in a low-lying area just off a trail that's passable for vehicles.
You know, I can only speculate how close searchers may have come and why that was difficult to find, but searching for things or people in the Alaska wilderness is not an easy thing to find people.
Ross read from a statement prepared on behalf of Rebecca Adams' family. It said they are grateful for the continued support of the community, as well as the time and effort put into this investigation by local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies. The family does not plan to give any interviews and asked for privacy as the investigation continues. In Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Shell Oil has replaced one of its top executives in charge of exploration off the coast of Alaska. As vice president of Shell's Alaska venture, Pete Slaby traveled the state to build support for Arctic drilling and defend the program against its critics. He left Anchorage almost 2 months ago for a new job at Shell's corporate headquarters. An engineer by training, Slaby's now in charge of decommissioning and restoring equipment for Shell's global operations. That change wasn't reported until last week in the trade publication Petroleum News. Spokeswoman Megan Baldino says it was announced internally at Shell and is not related to problems the company faced during its last Arctic drilling season.
He led the venture for 6 years, extending well beyond a typical assignment. I don't think anyone would argue that he leaves behind a legacy of leadership and working with communities and building partnerships, and that is, you know, that has positioned the venture for well into the future.
Baldino says an agreement between Shell and the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation to share in drilling proceeds is still going forward, even after Slaby's departure. For now, Shell is focused on securing legal permission to return to the Arctic this summer, and Lori Schmidt is stepping in as the new vice president for Shell in Alaska. Schmidt is an attorney who's been with Shell for 25 years. She has experience in internal auditing, overseeing contracting for drilling projects, and in community relations, both in Russia and in Nigeria.
So making sure that local people are trained and skilled to work on projects and can apply for and succeed in the jobs that are available anywhere where Shell works. So, for example, that was in Nigeria.
Schmidt has already been sent to Barrow and Unalaska to meet with stakeholders since she took over on February 1st. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan returned to Juneau and today gave his first speech as a senator to a joint session of the Alaska Legislature. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the first-term Republican established an us-versus-them theme, a united Alaska up against the Obama administration.
Sullivan, who ousted a Democrat in a tough race, opened with unity. Sullivan says Alaskans are one big family who survive life's ups and downs together.
Births, deaths, marriages, even elections.
Sullivan made a point of seeking out a Barrow Democrat who fell ill on the House floor last month.
It's great to see Representative Benny Nagiak looking as healthy as ever. Where are you, Benny? Oh, no. That was my first applause line.
Sullivan talked about his work on a veterans suicide bill and going to the White House for the signing ceremony. He says Alaskans need to align interests with people of every political stripe.
Certainly one that I've already started is working with both sides of the aisle on critical issues to our country, critical issues to our state. It's something that I do on a regular basis. In fact, Senator Murkowski, Representative Young, and I made a little news the other night. We had a potlatch dinner at the senator's house with the entire Hawaiian delegation, all Democrats.
But Sullivan was elected on a strong anti-Obama message, and he has stayed consistent. Sometimes, Sullivan says, interests can't be aligned.
On some of the most critical issues facing our state and country, the administration of Barack Obama does not have our interests at heart. This is becoming increasingly clear.
Sullivan says Alaskans want access to develop federal lands, big economic projects, and less regulation, while the administration wants the opposite.
We want a strong, secure Arctic, teeming with opportunity for our citizens and protected by a strong military presence in Alaska. They are looking at removing thousands of our Arctic tough soldiers.
The Army plans to cut brigade combat teams, possibly from Alaska. The Army's chief of staff says it's due to the 2011 Budget Control Act passed by Congress. Representative Adam Wohl, a Fairbanks Democrat, says this was the first time he'd heard Sullivan speak, other than in campaign ads.
And he said, my office door's always open. I work with Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Socialists, etc. But much of the speech seemed to be geared towards, it seemed kind of partisan.
Representative David Guttenberg, another Fairbanks Democrat, says he hopes Sullivan can deploy a different skill set than the one that got him elected.
To be a statesman, you need to, you know, which is what we need in the United States Senate, is you need to build the bridges. You need to make people see that you're relevant.
Guttenberg says he was delighted to hear about the dinner with the Hawaii delegation, which he says continues an important alliance forged by the late Senator Ted Stevens. But Guttenberg says he also heard a lot of blame, which he says isn't constructive.
Our guys need to be able to talk to the president, whoever he is. You know, you need to be able to have that dialogue. Alaska has interests that are so important. You need to not shut the door anywhere you turn. And blaming the president for every time you turn around is just the nature of the very partisanship that's going on back there.
Senator Lisa Murkowski made her annual speech to the legislature last month. No date has been announced yet for Congressman Don Young. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how does the Iditarod compare to summiting Everest? This year's Red Lantern weighs in.
For me, this was harder by far. Mostly because I had not just to worry about myself, I had to worry about all those dogs.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer in the United States and often has no symptoms. If you are 50 or older, talk with your doctor about colon screening today. Learn more at alaskacolonhealth.org. This message sponsored by Ride for Life.
New appointees to the board of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation express support for a major liquefied natural gas project the state is pursuing with oil and gas companies. The House Resources Committee held confirmation hearings for Rick Helford, Joe Paskvan, and Hugh Short. Paskvan said job number one is the major project known as Alaska LNG. If that falters, he said he believes Alaskans deserve the best shot at an economically viable alternative if one exists. Governor Bill Walker proposed increasing the size of a smaller standalone gas line project and turning it into a project capable of exports in case Alaska LNG faltered. Some lawmakers worry this could create uncertainty about Alaska LNG. State Senate Finance Committee members are going over proposed agency budgets one by one, looking for funds or programs they can cut. Last Thursday, they questioned Department of Environmental Conservation officials, asking just how bad it would be to turn down federal dollars for water and sewer systems. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
The governor's proposed $64 million capital budget for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, or DEC, is the agency's lowest in 10 years. The $55.5 million for water and sewer construction projects is 70% federal dollars. Wasilla Senator Mike Dunleavy, a Republican, asked Village Safe Water Facilities Program Manager Bill Griffith what would happen if the state didn't come up with its $9 million match.
If this doesn't happen this year, what happens? Does the world end? What goes on?
Griffith said turning down federal dollars would halt a multi-year process that awards funds based on highest public health or environmental need and community maintenance practices.
If we don't provide funds to projects that are kind of next in line, some of those have active construction that would stop and have to wait until additional funding is made available. Other ones are at the point where they're starting up, and they too would have to wait until there's funding available in the future.
Okay, so the world wouldn't end?
No.
Thank you.
Dunleavy went on to say the state is facing a budget deficit and agencies should be asking only for what's necessary to avert disaster.
I'll be asking this of every department. What is truly a need now that if it's not met now could be catastrophic? And what can wait? So if there's any way you can come to us and break those things out, that'd be very helpful.
Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon chairs the Senate Finance Committee.
I would just support Senator Dunleavy's comments and recognize the federal government is $18 trillion in debt, and that debt is being held by other nations. Certainly some of it's held in the nation, but again, it appears that this particular program has a 1-to-5 match. Can you speak to that if we don't match the money?
The state of Alaska has always come up with the match to federal dollars for water and sewer construction, so Griffith said he would have to find out more about what would happen if the state doesn't match federal funds.
I would have to probably research whether there's any limitation on their expectation on when we would provide the match. I know that they are... Every year, they expect us to have those federal funds along with the state match obligated within a year.
Alaska has the nation's highest percentage of people living without plumbing, just over 6% of Alaskans, or about 4,500 Alaskan households, use honey buckets as toilets and get their drinking water from rain catchment, rivers and lakes, or from a central watering point. Studies show the lack of plumbing in Alaska does contribute to diseases such as pneumonia and bronchiolitis and abscesses and other skin diseases. Griffith says the health gap between communities with running water and flush toilets and those without is significant.
Some of these studies have shown that skin infections and respiratory infections are five to ten times higher in communities that don't have a piped water and sewer system.
Griffith told legislators DEC is working with the private sector to come up with lower cost alternatives to centralized water systems. He says six companies are competing to come up with plans for a home-based decentralized system that would incorporate recycled water. I'm Jacqueline Estes.
The U.S. Forest Service says a Friday court decision allowing a timber sale will help speed changes in Tongass National Forest logging, but opponents say it will damage other Southeast Alaska industries. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Forest Service designed the bighorn sale as part of its transition from old growth to second or young growth timber cuts. 10 environmental organizations sued to block the sale, saying the acreage is critical habitat for deer and wolf populations, as well as salmon. The ruling was made by U.S. District Court Judge Ralph Beistlein. His 25-page decision rejects claims that the Forest Service failed to follow proper procedure before offering the sale. Beth Pendleton is regional forester for Alaska and oversees the Tongass.
It is critical to our overall transition and the ability to provide bridge timber to the industry here in Southeast as we make that complete transition to young growth in the next 10 to 15 years.
The court decision allows the agency to proceed with the sale, which includes about 6,000 acres of old-growth rainforest on Prince of Wales Island. Another approximately 2,000 acres of second-growth trees are also included. The suit, filed in August, says the agency did not properly consider the sale's impacts on wildlife. Southeast Alaska Conservation Council Executive Director Melina Marvin says logging bighorn would hurt other regional industries.
We have a thriving fishing and tourism economy here, and those are based on healthy streams and abundant wildlife, and both of those things are undercut by old-growth logging.
Bighorn is the largest timber sale planned for the Tongass, the nation's biggest national forest. The agency awarded a contract for about two-thirds of the acreage to Klooks Viking Lumber Company in October. It hoped to settle legal challenges in time for logging to start this spring. But the lawsuit isn't necessarily over. The plaintiffs could take the decision before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and seek an injunction pending the outcome. CX Marvin says the environmental groups will discuss whether they'll take that action. She says the suit includes views from more than those suing.
In our experience, local people would much rather see a small and sustainable wood industry that actually keeps money circulating in our communities instead of exporting old growth in the round to Asia.
The sale was first announced in the summer of 2013. Tongass officials said it could provide up to a decade's worth of timber for Viking and smaller mills. Environmentalists filed an agency appeal over impacts to wolves and other wildlife. They also pointed out that the area to be logged is home to about three-quarters of the world's population of a rare orchid. The Forest Service rejected that internal appeal, though it deferred offering some of the acreage. Regional Forester Pendleton says Beistlein's ruling shows the agency did its homework.
This decision really does validate the importance of the bighorn sale and the decision that was made associated with that.
The ruling comes as the Tongass Advisory Committee prepares to meet in Juneau. The 15-member panel is working on recommendations for an updated Tongass land management plan, including the transition from old to young growth logging. With Layla Carey in Ketchikan, I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The men and women of Public Employees Local 71 maintain over 20,000 miles of roads and runways and cook and care for those in Alaska's pioneer homes. Public Employees Local 71, working hard for Alaska, working hard for you. This message is sponsored by Public Employees Local 71.
Proposed funding cuts for Alaska state parks have caused a stir in Valdez, where the one park ranger position could be eliminated. KCHU's Marsha Lynn reports.
Word of the proposed cuts quickly spread to the local state parks community advisory board.
We got an email this, you know, discussing all these things, and the phrase that was used was that state parks facilities in the Valdez area were going to be abandoned by the state, and that speaks pretty loudly, I think, to their intentions.
Robin Capers is an avid outdoorsman who joined the CAB in October. She's dismayed about the state's attitude.
It shows a lack of respect and a lack of support by the state for this area and of the natural resources that we have in such abundance in this area.
After a multi-year gap without a Valdez Park Ranger, the position was reinstated about 3 years ago by the state legislature. The decision to cut park staff in Valdez, Sitka, and Dillingham came from a mandate by the House Subfinance Committee. It asked the State Department of Natural Resources to request that each division cut $500,000 from their FY16 budget. Claire LeClaire, Deputy Director and Chief of Field Operations for DNR's Division of Outdoor Recreation, says these cuts are their final solution.
You know, even our own staff said, well, couldn't we get there by people having shorter seasons or, you know, some other way besides basically not providing services in the two locations, Sitkin Valdez? And the answer is no, we can't shave our way to $500,000 worth of cuts. It's not possible.
This is the criteria they used.
The things that we looked at were visitation, revenue, and distance from an area office, but it was mainly revenue and visitation.
The CAB has appealed to the Valdez City Council for a resolution of support to keep the Valdez Ranger, but the final outcome is now in the hands of the state legislature. In Valdez, I'm Marsha Lynn.
The fourth time was the charm for the Freeride World Tour in Haines. The big mountain ski and snowboard competition made three attempts to hold the event, but canceled because of weather. Today, conditions were right for about 30 athletes. KHNS's Emily Files reports.
This was the Freeride's first ever stop in Alaska, and it hasn't been smooth sailing. After failed attempt, the organizers decided to try one more time on Monday. And sunny, clear skies welcomed the skiers onto a steep mountain face called The Venue.
We have sat out 12 days waiting for these conditions, and the snow up here is just phenomenal.
That's commentator Ed Lee with his fellow anchor Martin Winkler. The competition started around 9:30 a.m. with men's snowboarders.
As Sammy Ludke drops in, the first rider of the snowboard men here in Haines, Alaska.
American Lupke started out the competition strong. As athletes from around the world took on the mountain, Haines locals watched the competition through an online live stream at various locations around town. About 20 people sat around a big screen at the public library. Here's librarian Debbie Gravel.
I'm like the person going, it's pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, they're such great athletes, but oh my gosh, that's scary.
The library's IT guy and local skier Eric Stevens was watching too.
It's just been amazing to watch people open up this face, really. The big airs are nail-biting. They're exciting to watch.
Over at the Haines School, about 25 students crowded around a screen in that library.
How did he hold on to that?
Whoa. Ninth grader Seth Waldo says he got out of math class to watch.
We've been definitely asking all of our teachers about it.
And what have the teachers said?
They've said no.
Well, then we finally got the other teacher to buckle under the peer pressure.
Look at that real full line attack there. Carves out
great
hard
control.
Two more Americans topped the rankings in the men's skiing and women's snowboarding categories. 21-year-old rookie George Rodney gained a score of 87.75. Shannon Yates earned 79.5 points.
That was KHNS's Emily Files reporting from Haines. After two prior attempts this year's Red Lantern, Cindy Abbott completed her first Iditarod late last night. KNOM's Jen Ruckel has the story.
One, two, three.
Red Lantern Cindy Abbott finally crossed under the Burled Arch, the first woman and only the second person to summit Mount Everest and complete the 1,000-mile sled dog race.
Congratulations! Congratulations!
Great. Glad to be here.
It's a goal she's had for several years. She entered the Iditarod in 2013 and 2014, but had to scratch both years for the safety of her team due to personal injury.
It's been a long race. And it's been a long years getting here, seeing how this is my third try.
Cindy, can I ask you, when did you know this time that you were going to make it all the way to Nome?
When I started. Yeah, so we're going to write in now, Everest 2010, Iditarod 2015, and there we have it. Yeah, now there's my Nord Rare Disease Awareness banner. That's pretty cool.
Abbott, who lives with her husband and daughter in Irvine, California, teaches health science at California State University Fullerton. Abbott is an advocate for the National Organization of Rare Disorders. While training for Everest, she was diagnosed with Wagner's granulomatosis, a form of vasculitis. But Abbott, who is now blind in one eye, decided she wasn't giving up because she had a mountain to climb.
For 14 years, I went undiagnosed with a very rare disease, and then I was finally diagnosed. And so to help raise awareness, I took this banner to the top of Mount Everest, and it became the 40th American female to summit Everest in 2010. And then after that, they said, well, what are you going to do next, run the Alaskan Iditarod? And I said, yeah, that actually sounds like an awesome thing to do.
After 54 days on the mountain, Abbott reached the top of Everest with her Nord banner. And now she has stood with it under the World Arch.
Not too many people or things have been through both.
And how do the experiences compare?
Everest took 2 months living on a mountain. And this took 2 weeks or a little short of it, but for me, this was harder by far. Mostly because I had not just to worry about myself, I had to worry about all those dogs. So, no, this is pretty amazing.
Abbott began mushing in 2011 with Lance Mackey's Comeback Kennel. During her first attempt, she injured her leg but traversed 600 miles before scratching when medical examination revealed that her pelvis was broken in 2 places. Sunday night, with a strong team of 13 dogs, Abbott exchanged the symbolic red lantern for a daring climb up the Burled Arch to extinguish the widow's lamp, officially signifying the end of the last great race for 2015. It was the only challenge more terrifying than 1,000 miles of Alaskan wilderness.
No. This is not safe.
This is a picture.
This is scary here.
Abbott finished with a total elapsed time of 13 days, 11 hours, 19 minutes, and 51 seconds.
Cindy, thank you for closing out Iditarod number 43.
Abbott will be honored at her own Red Lantern Banquet at the Mini Convention Center in Nome at 6 o'clock tonight. And reporting under the Burled Arch in Nome, I'm Jen Ruckel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Marsha Lynn in Valdez, Jen Ruckel in Nome, and Emily Files in Haines. APRN's Liz Bruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Premier Dental Group. Smiles for Life is an annual campaign going on now through June for seriously ill, disabled, and underprivileged children. More at smilealaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The University of Alaska Southeast has programs in business, arts and sciences, education, and career education. UAS is a learning community where your professors are mentors and friends on campus and online. uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.